welcome, friends, new and regular listeners. Thank you for tuning in once again. I'm Henrik. This is Red Ice, the radio show. We have a couple of websites for you, redice.tv and redicemembers.com. Definitely check that out if you're new. Today we have Professor Ricardo Duchesne back on the show with us. Dr. Duchesne is a professor in the Department of Social Science at the University of New Brunswick, St. John. That's in Canada. His dissertation, All Countries Confounded, Historical Materialism and the Translation to Capitalism Debate, was awarded the Doctoral Prize Award for Best Dissertation of the Year. And also, of course, Ricardo is the author of The Uniqueness of Western Civilization. Last time he was on, we talked about Faustian Man in a Multicultural Age. And he also has a new book coming out a bit later. We're just going to give you a couple of tidbits from that. But it's good to have you back on the show again, Ricardo. Thank you for coming on.
Hello, Henrik. Yes, it's good to hear from you and to be again with Red Eyes and its audience.
Excellent. So you're, of course, one of our beloved anti-PC professors. For those who are new to your work, you have seen the light when it comes to the immensely both anti-Western, but also at this point, anti-free speech pressure that takes place on campuses and universities and colleges and everything else. And you together with the other few professors have started to wake up to this, of course. And it's always such a pleasure to bring you on and talk about these things and not only about your academic work, but just your general view. You, of course, have had a lot of troubles at the university just about a year or so ago. There was a lot of people that tried to push you out, and there were quite a bit of writing about you just because of the fact that you dare to take a position where you defend the West. Has there been any more pressure on your position since we last spoke?
Well, that was the second interview we did that we discussed about the troubles that I was having at the university. And since then, there have been a few issues, but one of the things I decided to do was to concentrate on the writing of this book that just came out, Faustian Man, and the one that I just finished the manuscript for, which is on Canada. I felt it was important to concentrate on intellectual work, academic work, just to let these books out, and because I had so many things in my mind that I wanted to write down. On top of the blog that I have, which I use quite a bit for first draft versions of what then I try to put into the book. So I kind of decided to calm down a bit at my university. Before, I used to tease a lot academics, send them emails, challenge them, question them, call them names and that sort of thing. And some of these guys would then complain and write to the administration at the university. And that's how some of the controversies started. But I'm planning a series of activities in the coming year. But it's not going to be revolving around my university per se. But I want to go out there more in the public and really take on the whole notion that Canada and that Western nations must become diverse. I want to really question that because things are getting really serious now. There is a very strong momentum against the whole European world with this ongoing, relentless immigration, the recurring rapes all across Europe. I mean, you know the story. And so I think that me being in a university, and I would say I don't know anyone else, at least in Canada, that's in an academic position and that is taking this issue of immigration. We have some people that are very good. And I know, for example, Janice Fiamengo, I like her, and she has some really good ideas against feminism. But for whatever reason, she doesn't really touch on the issue of immigration generally, although she is a keen critic of the Muslim issue. And then there is another guy that came into prominence this year, Jordan Peterson.
Yeah, that's right. I was just going to bring him up. Yeah.
Right. He addresses gender issues. But the real issue that sends the whole system into a hysterical crisis or reaction is mass immigration, simply put. In other words, you're not saying that Muslim or radical Muslims are a problem. You're simply saying that the coming marginalization of white people is a problem. That really gets them going. And I don't know anyone in academia that is addressing this issue, so I feel that in my position in academia, it's time for me to start just pressing this issue to the public in whichever way I can. And I did a bit of that this semester after I completed this manuscript on Canada. I felt I could take a break and become a bit more political. So we can talk about that later on.
Yeah, definitely. Just tell us about that, the concern that you feel, the drive that you have for this, what the reasons behind you wanting to take on this issue and take this role, I guess, to be more outspoken. I mean, I think you have what it takes to do that because of your academic background. You're so knowledgeable, of course, and you have already been given a little bit of the limelight, so to speak. So if you can pressure, you know, put some pressure and even more on these issues, I think that could kind of, you could come into, basically you could help to highlight these issues much more than some other people have. But just for the listening audience who maybe, let's say they're new to the show or something like that, they want to try to understand that, explain that a bit to us of why you feel that this is so important and why you want to step into that role.
Well, many times I ask myself, why did I reach this political position? Because I was on the left, as you know, initially. And one of the things that got me going was very intellectually was the interpretation of Western civilization in comparative perspective. Why did the West become the first modern society? Why England industrialized first? And from there, I began to open up that question into why the Greeks were the progenitors of rational understanding of the world, of civic citizenship. And then I realized that they invented deductive reasoning, dialogical reasoning, and so on and so on. And then the Romans too were quite unique in the legal system, and through that into Catholicism and the scholastic system, the invention of universities, the Renaissance, the discovery of the world, the cartographic revolution. So it was one thing after another that I realized, look, the West is an incredible civilization. It's so different, and it has achieved far more than any other civilization. In fact, if I had to put a score of what the West achieved in the arts, the sciences, and so on, vis-a-vis all the other civilizations combined, I would say it's 97-3. And I know some people think this is crazy and it's just exaggerated. And I'm not going to defend that view now, but just to let you know, that's sort of the view I have. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things that propelled me in this direction is that I just couldn't take the deception that I saw in universities with the promotion of world history and the idea that all civilizations were more or less alike, that they, you know, there were variations, but the West was kind of just lucky or maybe industrialized first, but that was just one thing, that humanity has to be seen as an interconnected web of peoples interacting with each other. And I realized these things were not true, and the reason they were being promoted is because they were consistent with the effort to create a multicultural society in which all peoples and cultures feel that they are equally represented in the curriculum or in society. So I challenged this, and then later on, around the time that we first did an interview, by then I was kind of aware that there was this issue of mass immigration going on across the West, and that behind it, there were also many deceptions going on. For one, we were being told that diversity is inherently good, and I could never see real evidence for that. It's worse than that. You just couldn't even talk about it. You had to accept it. And to me, that was inconsistent with my role as a professor, which is to debate and examine all issues. And I noticed that this was one issue that whenever you brought it up, people would sort of feel uncomfortable or put a label on it. Or it was just amazing for me to see these so-called critical thinkers, because they call themselves that, unable to handle this issue. I would say, well, why is it that Canada has to become increasingly more diverse? Why don't we promote the birth rate among the populations that are already here? and things like that, you could see that it was just unacceptable. And so from there, it just became more and more a process of digging into all these issues. And I guess, I mean, you could say what propelled me is just I don't like the feeling that I'm being deceived, that they think yeah. I'm stupid, and that they're playing games, and that they're just going to use labels, and I'm just going to keep quiet and accept what they're saying, because it's just the whole thing is just a lie, and we can talk about that, but it's really a massive deception of the likes we have never seen in history.
Why do you think that is? I mean, we're kind of getting into a little bit of a deeper philosophical thing here now, but this is interesting, just kind of talk from your perspective, from the man behind the academic work, what drives you and so forth. But why do you think they, because isn't it a big risk that they take? I mean, to academically being disingenuous, being dishonest, that can help to discredit institutions, authors, academics, people, and all these kinds of things if it's found out, which suggests to me then that they're willing to take that risk because in their view, the benefit that they get out of it, which is a multicultural society, that's really the priority, right?
Yes, it's a long, drawn-out process. That is the process by which the West came to believe that mass immigration is a good thing. There is no one answer. In the book that I just completed on Canada, I tried to answer this question by looking at when and why Canada decided that they could no longer have an immigration system which prioritized white people, that they had to eliminate all racial criteria. And they did this quite recently. It was really in 1967 that they eliminated what people call all remaining racial criteria for the acceptance of immigrants. But you could say in 1962, it really already happened, but that's still quite recent. So I look into this in a lot of detail. And one of the things that I show, this is in the last part of that book, part four, is that the whole West was caught up with this notion after World War II in particular. I mean, you can go back deep into Western history, and the European New Right has done that, and this fourth book that I'm thinking about on the alternative right and the Western civilization will examine these things. That is, to what degree was the Reformation part of the process that led to where we are today, or Christianity, like Alain de Benoist blames Christianity a lot, mm-hmm. although he's not really as preoccupied with diversity as I am. But you can go way back in Western history, but I decided to point to what happened right after World War II. The World War II was a kind of a turning point in the West, because in World War II, if you look at the countries that fought Nazi Germany, Australia, the United States, Canada, those three settler nations, which were known as immigrant nations, if you look at them, all of them, by the standards of today, were white supremacist nations. By the standards of today, they're all-out Nazi nations. So right. Here are these nations that fought Nazi Germany at that time. Now they would be identified as being just as Nazi. But they were not. They were actually nations with representative institutions, the rule of law, relative freedom of the press, even more so than now, actually. People were freer then than they are today. Independent universities, the government was not telling them what they should teach and what books they should use. So all in all, you could argue they were liberal democratic nations, but they had this wide immigration policies, all of them. So I try to get into the question, why did they abandon, why did they drop these immigration policies? Now, we know that Kevin McDonough has done excellent work for the United States, examining what led to the 1965 new immigration law mm. in the United States.
Yep.
And Canada is a bit different, the situation. So I look at the case of Canada only, and I don't want to say that what transpired in Canada can be extended to every other Western nation, but there are parallels and commonalities here. And what I sense is that there were four basic things or norms. I call them four norms that were kind of instituted right after World War II. And then these norms became radicalized. And that their radicalization was sort of already inherent to the nature of these norms. And just very quickly, because we can talk about this book later on, but just very quickly, the first norm is that people in the West came to believe that racism was the worst evil of modern times, and that Western governments had committed crimes against humanity. That is, the Nazis and fascist governments had committed crimes against humanity, the Holocaust, and that these crimes were a demonstration of what's so wrong about racist ideas. Then another norm that is linked to this one is that race is a construct. There is no such thing as race in the biological sense. So any kind of scientific investigation of racial differences was completely and utterly discredited in the Western world. You could not talk about it in biological terms. The differences between different nationalities and culture, the argument was, are due to cultural and environmental factors, not biological differences. Another norm phenomenon that happened after World War II is that Western colonialism was completely discredited. And combined with this, there was this idea that third world peoples embodied the natural goodness of humanity insofar as they were freed from the corrupting influence of Western imperialism, and that the West was not a civilizing force, but that the West had committed all sorts of horrible acts in the third world. And ultimately, Western peoples were blamed for the undeveloped state of the third world, that the Western peoples had become wealthy and affluent because they took all these things from the rest of the world through the black slave trade, the Spanish extraction of gold and silver, and into the 20th century through corporate control of the economies and resources of the third world.
Mm.
So that sort of was the third norm. I should say that I kind of left something in, I think it was the second norm that I mentioned. I kind of got stuck with the race issue, but I meant to say that insofar as race was viewed, that's just the first norm, insofar as race was viewed as something that is associated with Nazism and crimes against humanity, Western nations came to the idea that they cannot have an ethnic identity, that they must have a civic identity, and mm-hmm. that is inherent to being a person from the West. So that's the first norm. The second one is simply the outlawing of race. Race is a construct.
Yeah.
So then the fourth one is this emergence of human rights. Human rights took off after World War II. And what this norm says is that all human beings, as human beings, are born with these natural rights to life, security, quality, dignity, and so on. And this is not easy, but what happened here is that Western people begin to look at other people outside the West, these naturally good people from the third world, they begin to look at them and to think that they have naturally the same rights as them, that they should have the same rights, and that when they arrive into Western nations, Western peoples have to think of them as having kind of almost, I mean, increasingly when people talk about no borders, that's what they're getting at. There should be no borders because they're just as human as we are. They have the same natural rights that we have, and they should have the same rights of citizenship mm-hmm. as we do.
Yeah.
And the moment they arrive, they're viewed that way. What's happening in the United States when you have all these cities becoming cities that accommodate and protect illegals, I mean, is a reflection of this human rights revolution that yeah. happened in the West.
Yeah.
So, you know, to your question, what happened in the West, I think this is one way to approach it. There are other ways, but I would say these four norms kind of took off and took over the Western world after World War II.
You know, there's a lot of course, intellectual struggle and push and cultural influence that's been going on behind all these norms that you bring up, the four or 5 points that you mentioned here. You have, for example, the work of someone like Stephen Jay Gould, who was into the race issue specifically, talking about this book, The Mismeasure of Man. You had people like Howard Zinn that was there to kind of discredit the historical view of the West, I would say. But then there's others, of course. The emergence of human rights was pushed by the Roosevelts, Eleanor Roosevelt, specifically at the yeah. UN. In terms of the immigration, you had, as you said, the Hart-Celler Act in America, and there were many similar ones in other parts of the world, also towards the mid-60s or the late 60s. So it's on many fronts, and there's a lot of different, people pushing for this. But what we can say in terms of the conclusion is that this view obviously ended up dominating not only the universities, but also the cultural narrative that we have in the media, in newspapers, in academia, on television, movies, and everything. It's a very broad range that this worldview that you presented, these norms, have completely invaded our space, so to speak. And today, there is practically no room for an opposition to these norms, right?
Yeah, there is no room. And what they did, and they were very successful at doing, is that they persuaded everyone that these norms were a natural outgrowth of liberalism and democracy.
Yeah.
That they were somehow that if you wanted to really be a liberal, then you would have to accept these norms. And one of the things I do in the book is that I show that that's completely untrue. In fact, these norms have led to a climate that is incredibly illiberal. And I mean, just take the second norm, the idea that race is a construct. There is nothing in liberalism that says that you have to accept that idea. They have actually closed debate, which is central to liberalism. They have closed off freedom of expression in order for everyone to believe that it is a construct. They're not allowing openly the idea that there may be some genetic factor, that there are differences between different populations in the planet, and that we can explain these differences using Darwinian theory.
Mm.
So they don't allow that. And that's illiberal. And there is nothing inherently illiberal about the argument that people, Nicholas Wade from the New York Times made. I mean, this guy's his writings before has always been your typical liberal, but he came to the conclusion that the biology, the genetics do point strongly towards the idea that there are some substantial or important differences between races. And then the other one is this idea that Western nations, if they are to be true to their liberal principles, they must be civic in character. Again, there is nothing illiberal about the idea that, first, this is not true. Secondly, that you can have, and you did have, ethnic-oriented nations, as I just said, the nations of Australia, the United States, and Canada, which fought against Nazism, were ethnically-oriented nations. They had white immigration policies, and they were liberal and democratic. So this whole idea that liberalism by necessity leads to a civic identity is simply not true. That was superimposed later in the Western world. And so in case the listeners here don't know this distinction between civic and ethnic identity, just to let them know, civic identity means that Western nations are based on values. And today those values have become ever more radical. So let's say today people will say that all Western nations, what identifies them, is that they have tolerance, that they believe in freedom of the press, rule of law, democratic government, and if you accept these values, then you can be just as much a Canadian as anybody else. So that there is no more to being a Canadian than just the acceptance of those values. And moreover, the argument is that these values are universal. They're values that human beings would endorse if they're given the opportunity to do so. And so there are values for humanity. But when you look at the history of European nations and how they were created, the nations that had the strongest ethnic cohesion were the ones that actually became the most liberal. Whereas those nations in the Austro-Hungarian Empire that had all kinds of mixed territorially contested territories by different ethnic groups, and there was sort of no ethnic cohesion, they were the ones that produced the more authoritarian, disorderly types of governments. And so when you look at the history of Sweden in its formation to becoming a nation, of Finland, of Britain, including France, there was considerable ethnic cohesion behind in the making of these nations.
Well, let me just interject that quickly. I mean, your point is very important. I mean, that ethnic identity was, I think, it's a given. It was such an obvious point, in fact, that it was not something that was written up anywhere in the law. I mean, the very concept of the nation was one that actually arose from an ethnic point of view, right? And I know that you can talk technically about the nation state being a fairly recent phenomena, fairly recent concept, historically speaking, but what led to that nation state has been a tribal group, in-group kind of awareness, if you will, right? That was belonging to the ethnic group. Everything they did was for their own tribe, if you will, at some point. And this progression through history, it grew larger. They did acquire territories. Sure, maybe some other tribes were incorporated into that as these nation states formed, but that largely was an ethnic identity that they held, right?
Yes. I have this longish article in the Occidental Quarterly on the origins of the idea of civic identity, and it goes back to the ancient Greeks, to the Romans. One of the things that these liberals who argue that the West today is inherently civic is that they go back and they say, well, the Greeks started this, then the Romans, and it cannot develop fully in the 20th century. But when you go back in time, it is very clear that the Greeks did not have the kind of civic conception that we have today, nor did the Romans. And when you look at the origins of nationalism in Europe, the people who make claims as to why France has a national identity or England, they always appeal to ancestral identities, to a people being rooted in a land for centuries, to long-held memories, heroes, the sense of territoriality. And this is something that has now really been recognized by various scholars. The foremost scholars, like his first name just escapes me now, but the second one is a very common name, is Smith. And then More recently, a guy that is from Israel, Asar Gad, goes beyond Smith and says that throughout history, there has always been a core ethnic background to a people's sense of identity and territoriality. He offers a sociobiological interpretation of the formation of nations. In that article, I criticize Asar Gad for not being consistent when he looks at present-day Western nations, because at that point, Asar Gad starts kind of saying, well, Western identity has always been characterized by acceptance of immigrants, and I guess all these Mexicans are coming to the United States, so that's what it means to be an American, and then he extends that into Europe. And I sort of had an email exchange with him, and in the end, he really realized, in my view, that he was just being consistent and just going along with the politically correct trends. That in fact, one could argue that the only reason Western nations believe that their identity now is multicultural is because that has been imposed over them. Because they're not allowed to voice the views we are voicing here. Because the moment you say, well, look, hold on, even in the case of Canada, which is a settler nation, if you say, well, look, in 1971, Canada was 96% white and European. And the institutions, the parliamentary system, the legal system, the infrastructure, everything had been created by the French and the Anglo peoples. And to simply say that that was not what Canada was based on, that it was based on these strong ethnic groups, and that they identified and created this nation, it's just nonsense. To simply project back the kind of diversity you have today, the number of Pakistanis and Muslims and Africans you have today, and to project back that into the history of Canada and say that Canada was always, you know, it was an identity was that was diverse from the beginning, it's just deception. And he kind of knew that he was just making up this argument and was not being consistent with what he had said about other nations.
Interesting. So tell us about that a little bit, because you write about that in the new book, right? The idea of pioneers and settlers. There's a slight difference between them, but that's both of those groups are very, very different than an immigrant coming to a country where everything is basically well established. They have a, you know, in some cases, a structure of welfare to go to and everything else, while pioneers and settlers, of course, came to most cases a barren land and basically started to create something out of that environment, right?
Yes, in the first part of this book that I just completed on Canada, and the tentative title of that book is Mass Immigration, Diversity, and the Destruction of Canada. In the first part, I challenged the idea that Canada is a nation of immigrants. This is an idea that is totally accepted across the board by the media and by all academics and historians. And it's simply a false idea. You can demonstrate statistically with complete certitude that it is a false idea. And one of the things I do is I go right to the beginnings of Canadian history to demonstrate that you cannot argue that Canada is a nation of immigrants. I'll just give you a few of the statistics that I bring up. This is kind of like a general statistic. Over the 400 years before Confederation was in 1867. So over the 400 years before Confederation, there were only two limited periods of substantial arrivals of immigrants, from 1783 to 1812, and from 1830 to 1850. And in those two periods, the immigrants were overwhelmingly of British origin. So it wasn't a diverse group of immigrants, because this is something else that they want to or have imposed on students, which is that immigrants were always diverse, coming from all kinds of areas of the world. It's not true. The other thing is that when you look at the numbers, immigration was not a major factor in population growth from 1850 to the end of the 19th century. It was rather a high rate of natural increase that allowed the population to grow even in the 19th century. But I have other statistics that are even more substantial and revealing. If you look at the earlier periods, I just gave you numbers for the 19th century, which is the period in which people say we had the highest immigration numbers into the 20th century. But if you go back to the 17th century, into the 18th century, and at that point you're talking about French Canada, because the French Canadians were the first ones here. The Quebecois, as they are known today, you will find that I don't have for this one particularly the proportion right now, but the percentage of the population that was immigrant in the region that is known as Quebec today or New France, say in the late 1700s, the percentage was like less than 20%. The rest were people that were born here through a very high fertility rate. Quebecois women had like 4-point-something surviving children per couple, 5.6 surviving children.
Nice.
And the Quebecois, a people, you could argue, are indigenous to this region of New France, because they cannot be found anywhere else in the world. So there were French-speaking people here. They came as immigrants first, but then through a very high fertility rate, they created a massive population in what later came to be known as Quebec. And that population grew from the soil of Canada, a very different soil, not to be found anywhere else in the world. And it would be inaccurate to say that these are just people from France growing up here, because they develop different cooking habits, costumes, agricultural relationships, and so on. The same goes with the Acadians. The Acadians are also French-speaking people. They first began to emerge in what is known today as Nova Scotia, but then they were kicked out of there and they moved to where I am, the province of New Brunswick in the northern area. These people are not to be found anywhere else. So they are indigenous to Canada. They self-created themselves through a very high fertility rate. And you can even argue that about the loyalists. The loyalists, yes, they came originally from the United States, and they, the main, were the ones behind the creation of Ontario. You could say easily that the loyalists themselves had grown up when they were not loyalists then, but they were people that remained loyal to Britain when the War of Independence happened in the 1770s in the United States. These people had grown through a high fertility rate in the United States. And then basically when they moved to Canada, many of them, they just moved from one region of British North America to another region. It wasn't a long movement. If you look at the maps, and I have some maps about that, and then they began again through a very high fertility rate to drive the population or the demographic history of Ontario. And so another argument that I make is that besides these indigenous people, besides the high fertility rate relative to immigration numbers, you can argue that none of them were immigrants because they were pioneers and they were settlers. Samuel Huntington had, that's his name, right? Samuel Huntington?
Yep, that's he, right.
Right. He made this argument for the United States. He said that the people who created the United States cannot be seen as immigrants because they actually created a whole new nation that later came to be called the United States. And they were settlers because they developed agriculture from a wilderness and they created all sorts of institutions that were not existing there before. So it's not like people arriving to a ready-made nation as it is the case today. And when you look at the dictionary definitions, they're consistent with what Huntington says. You look at the Oxford Dictionary, any dictionary you want, they will tell you that the people that have been coming to Australia, you know, before multiculturalism and this diversity stuff started, that most of these people were pioneers, the ones who came first. Pioneer means that you pioneer something new. So you're the one who pioneered parliamentary institutions in Canada, the legal system in Quebec, the infrastructure. Settler means that you cannot come to a nation that already has some of the basic institutional groundwork, but nevertheless, you settle into new areas of that nation. You create farms. You industrialize that nation. So these people were both pioneers and settlers, and immigrants, really, to me, the term, you could use it for people coming to the large cities in the late 19th into the 20th century. But those Europeans that came to those large cities, they were not like the immigrants of today, because they were coming here. They had to take care of themselves. There was no welfare. There was no multiculturalism waiting for them. So it's a very different reality from what you have today. And historians should know better that one of the things you're told, and I study history. I mean, my BAMA is in history, and I have always kept on studying history. One of the things that you learn in history is that you need to be aware of different historical epochs and how things have changed through time, and how it is that you cannot take a label like capitalism and go back to Renaissance Italy and use the same label there. You have to be aware that it was a different reality. But in this case, they don't care. They just say, oh, we are a nation of immigrants. We have been immigrants since the 1600s right up until today. And the foremost historians argue this. In my book or this manuscript, I go through a lot of different historical sources showing how they keep making this claim and how they're wrong in making that claim.
Yeah, they are wrong. It's as you say, it's just not true. And well, give them time. They'll probably redefine these terms, right, of pioneer and settler eventually, like they have with so many other things, unfortunately. But what about this claim that, well, because it's, you know, let me play devil's advocate a bit. And there's always things that the left throws at you when you begin to talk about these kinds of things. The immediate response is one of aggression and dismissal, which is, well, those people or you people or whatever, you killed all the natives anyway. Right, so morally, you're already in the wrong position. Now, we know that this is subjected in America all the time. There's an ongoing debate where they try to demonize white European people that are there today for this reason, to basically delegitimize them, to prevent them from having a sense of both identity, but also a sense of belonging to the nation. Is it the same in Canada with these arguments?
Oh, yes, for sure. I mean, white guilt exists at every level. One level at which it really exists in a strong way in Canada has to do with the way natives were treated unfairly, and they say in a genocidal fashion by these imperialistic colonizing peoples. As I just said, the Quebecois and the Acadians and elements of the English-speaking population can be said to be indigenous to Canada, if not pioneers and settlers. But nevertheless, they paint a picture in which these colonizers came in and got rid of the natives. But it's really not true. I do have a section on the natives. One of the things I show is that there was a lot of give and take in the interaction between these two groups. The natives of Canada, as was the case in other nations that the Europeans arrived to, were divided into different tribal groups. They didn't have a sense of national identity. They did have a tribal identity. And the Hurons, the Iroquois, and other native groups were in a constant state of conflict with each other. And the Europeans played up those divisions, but the natives were not passive recipients of these European divisive tactics. In fact, they were very much involved in using the Europeans to fight against another native group.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to make claims that I'm by any means an expert on the history of the natives. But what I do is that I look at the way in which these politically correct historians write about the natives, and it's always in a very kind of naive, infantile way. They paint them as really good people, and they were just exploited by the Europeans and that sort of thing. And they had such good costumes and such a ecological relationship with the environment, none of which is true. And really what they do is they don't paint them as real human beings, people that were proud in their own way, that were tough in their own way, that willfully interacted with Europeans. They wanted some of the goods the Europeans had that were useful for them in their struggle with other tribal groups. Obviously, we know about gunpowder weapons, but it was also the fact that natives did not have iron tools by any means, and they really liked those. And so, you know, it was a long drawn out process that happened over a few hundred years of interaction between the two. And through no one's fault, a lot of these natives fell to diseases which the Europeans did not transfer to them because they wanted to kill them or anything like that. It just happened. And this had a very negative effect on the natives. But I think the way we should view them is the way they were viewed in the past. And I do go back to a few works that were written long ago that, in my view, give a more accurate rendition of how the natives were portrayed, them as real men, tough guys. Don't patronize them. They don't need that. Some of them today, they don't mind if you call them Indians. They say that's fine. The whole term of natives, aboriginals, are just welfare terms created many times by whites themselves. So I kind of go into that a bit in the book.
That's interesting. You know, I was thinking about a couple of other things. We were talking before we began, you were talking about a couple of people that have promoted this specifically in Canada. They had even traveled around to kind of sell this idea and everything else. One was, I think it was William Leica and also Charles Taylor. Tell us about these two gentlemen.
Yeah, in part two of this manuscript, I challenged the whole ideology of multiculturalism. One of the things I do tell people that are not from Canada is that they need to understand that Canada is the most advanced multicultural nation in the world. It is the place that developed this ideology to the most, and that it is Wilkin Leica and Charles Taylor are known as the foremost thinkers of multiculturalism, of the idea that this is the best way for Western nations to go. And Wilkin Leica has spent his entire career in Europe selling the multicultural model in Germany, in Sweden, in Britain. And he's not a very forthright person, because when he senses that this model is not working in Europe because of the Muslim terroristic acts and other reactions against it, he kind of says, oh, well, we Canadians should not think that what's happening in Europe is going to happen here. Here the model is really working. And then he goes on into what makes the Canadian model different from what is happening in Europe. And yet at the same time, as I just said, he has spent almost his entire academic career teaching and lecturing in Europe, promoting this model there. So he has to be held responsible. If you just Google his name, Wilkin Leica, you will see that he's been there all the time. And you will see that he has a very long, long publishing record in which he is incessantly promoting this multicultural model around the world. And the same thing is with Charles Taylor, although to a lesser degree, because he's also known as, you might say, Canada's foremost thinker since World War II. So what I do is I have two long chapters on I actually have two chapters of Wilkin Leica and one chapter on Charles Taylor, and I go into detail about their ideas and challenge them. And basically, not to go into too many details, but just to give you the gist of my argument, is that it is really amazing that both of them argue that multiculturalism is the liberal way to go, because we need to recognize that all human beings have a disposition to have their ethnic identity and their culture respected. So we cannot expect, when immigrants arrive here or the minorities that are here, we cannot expect them to assimilate to the Western culture, the Western way of life, but should rather acknowledge that they have a right to retain their cultural ways within a liberal framework, but they have a right to retain aspects of their culture that do not go against what they view or think of as liberalism. And I mean, they really get into the whole idea that it is part of human nature to want to be validated as members of a collective cultural ethnic identity, and that multiculturalism is a good thing because that's what it does. It validates that aspect of human nature. Charles Taylor is a bit stronger in making this collective argument, whereas Ken Lika says, or you could argue, makes the collective argument as a temporary phenomenon, that for a time we should give them room to affirm and feel comfortable in their cultural ways as they gradually adjust and become more Western-like. But in any case, it's interesting that the very same thinkers who believe that it is intrinsic to human nature to have this collective ethnic identity completely exclude European Canadians from having that kind of identity. Rather, they feel that Canadians need to be open to every other culture. They need to welcome all these different peoples, and that is their identity. Their identity is to accept the identities of peoples from all over the world, and they better not affirm their identity because that is racist and that is Nazi. So this is incredible contradiction right at the heart of their right thinking.
Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, it's amazing. How did you spell the last name? Lika or Lika? How do you spell that? I'm trying to search for it.
It's K-Y-L-I-M-C-K-A.
Kim. Oh, yeah. Kim Lika, right? Is that? Yeah, that's right. That's how I read it. Kim Lika.
If you put Will and put quotation marks in his name, you'll see you'll get thousands and thousands of hits.
That's right. Okay. Yeah. That's right. You guys had quite a bit of writings about him on Council of European Canadians already. So I urge people to check that out as well. We're going to take a short break here, and then we're going to continue more with Ricardo Duchesne after the break and talk more about also the alt-right and some of the kind of later developments. I want to get his take on that. Much more to get into, but the books then that we should promote as well, Ricardo, is obviously The Uniqueness of Western Civilization. We talked last time about Faustian Man in a Multicultural Age. It was not out at that point. It is out now, and it is available both on Arctos and Amazon as well. And then, as you say, then you basically have two more in the pipeline coming out. One on Canada, and then one on some of the views, I guess, within the alt-right, correct?
No, the one on the alt-right is I don't have that finished at all. I already started it.
Yep.
But it's not on the pipeline. The one on Canada is already in the hands of a publisher, and they're reviewing it.
Right. Very good. So that might be, I don't know how long that takes, but it might be available in, a few months or something if they accept it, maybe. We'll see.
They promise if they do accept it, I'll have it ready soon.
Okay. That's good. We can definitely do a more in-depth, show in just that alone and talk a bit more. And once I get an idea of what's in the book more, then we can definitely go into detail about that. But, okay. So that's very good. Eurocanadian.ca a good site to go to find out more about your writing, Ricardo?
Yeah, people can go there. If they want to see the more finished, published version of some of my writings, they can go to ResearchGate. I have a my publications there.
Okay, and, so researchgate.net, is that the resource?
Yes.
We'll add a link to that then, Ricardo, so people can check out that. I guess it's academics that submit papers and articles and things like that there?
Yeah, I can give you later the actual link with my name that would get them directly to where I am there.
Yeah, definitely do that. Okay, folks, so we'll have that link in the description, under the description text, so check that out for more of Ricardo's writing. But yeah, we'll take a short break here. Ladies and gentlemen, stay with us. We'll be right back with more after a short break.